Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, and we will continue our ever-expanding and changing investigation into the culture of consciousness. About a month or so ago, I had the blessing of being able to visit Athens, a place I had lived when I was a kid for a year or so, and this time I went to someplace new. I wanted to visit the site of Eleusis, which, as we'll find out more about later this program, was the site of the longest-running mystery initiation tradition in the ancient world. And if you look in the guidebooks and sort of talk to, travelers who go to see all the sites, people will often talk about Eleusis as being not that special, not that much to see. It's in a industrial suburb of Athens that's sort of a pain to get to, and it's, surrounded by oil derricks and blah, blah, blah. And so I had never been, but for some reason I was very much called this time, and even though my Greek cousin of mine was saying, oh, it's a pain, you don't want to go there, it's just out in the middle of nowhere, you'll get lost. So I said, no, I'm going to go, and I got on the bus, and I found the right bus, and I wandered around the town, and I finally found this site, and it was remarkable. And it was remarkable because it was sort of overgrown, there was hardly anybody there, it was like 10 in the morning, and it was enchanted, it was a very powerful place. And you could really see, even though there weren't any tall buildings, any large structures, pillars or gateways, any of that kind of stuff left, you could really see the organization of space and how the pilgrims came to this site and where they gathered and where they passed and the wells and the sacred cave that was associated with Pluto, and then eventually where they would step up on to the telestrion, which was the main building where these mysterious rituals of life and death were displayed and performed for these initiates once a year. All it is now is kind of a crumbled plateau. There's no pillars or anything, although it used to be a whole building. And when I stepped up there, it was a very powerful experience, and I got a really strong sense of energy, of presence, of the kind of sacred resonance that buildings and ancient places that have been used for sacred purposes often have. And so even though it was surrounded by industrial stuff and it wasn't that built up and there, it was a lot of crab grass and stuff everywhere, it was one of the more powerful places I've been in. I've been in Greece. So I'm very happy today that we'll be talking to Charles Stein, who is a poet and independent scholar who's written a number of books about poetry and Greek lore, and his latest book is called Persephone Unveiled, and it's about the secrets of Eleusis, and we'll talk more about that. But first I'd like to bring on our esoteric librarian, Maja. How are you doing today, Maja?
I'm good, Eric. How are you?
Good. I'm wondering, out of that vast treasure trove of data that you carry around in your skull, you got an interesting trivia about Eleusis? I'm sure you're quite familiar with the mysteries.
I really got into the Eleusian mysteries because it was so fascinating to me, because most of the time when you read about a lot of these pagan initiatic cults, they focus around Dionysus and Bacchus, and that's like all the ecstatic cults and everything are affiliated with, the dudes. But the Eleusian mysteries are like one of the only examples really that you can find that are still kind of going on of the dark feminine cults that are literally like focused around ecstasy and blood rituals and stuff like that have to do with these two extremely dark feminine figures and going into the underworld, which is associated with, you know, lady mysteries as well. Like, that has been almost literally eradicated out of every other culture and tradition, with the exception of the Eleusinian kind of rites and stuff like that. So for me, it's very interesting that that has, you know, been able to kind of keep together that dark feminine ritual aspect, whereas in many other parts of the world, it's totally fallen apart.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. You can the whole core myth, of course, revolves around a mother-daughter relationship and the kind of war over women and their autonomy versus their kind of the way they're sort of drawn into society. But before I mangle the tale anymore, let's bring on Mr. Stein. Charles, thanks for joining us here on Expanding Mind.
I'm glad, Charles, to be here.
Good, good. Just for folks who are not as familiar with the mysteries, could you just give us a little thumbnail sketch of the rites and the myths that they're based on? I know it's a very long, complicated thing, but be good to start out with a little bit of shared ground.
They're mysteries of Demeter and Persephone. They were celebrated in Eleusis about 13, 14 miles outside of Athens. And their earliest performance of these rites was during the Mycenaean Age, which would have been probably around 1400 BC. So we're talking a good 900 years before the classical age of the famous Athenians that we know of, the playwrights and philosophers and sculptors and so forth. The mysteries celebrated Demeter and Persephone and were believed to create for their initiates a improved situation in the afterlife. That is, when they when the souls of the participants went to Hades, they were supposed to get some better deal there. And the rites were extremely secretive, though at the heyday, as many as 4,000 people would celebrate them at the same time. The demand for secrecy about what the rites actually consisted of were very, very stringent. You were supposedly punished by death if you revealed the content of the mysteries. Nonetheless, various authors say various things about it, so one has a kind of impression that what happened at these rites was that, first of all, there was a year and a half time of preparation that a prospective initiate would have to go through, purifications and tutelage in the myths and doctrines, as it were, pertinent to the rites, and then a week during which very specific things would occur, and a march from Athens proper to Eleusis that took an entire day, involved passing over a mysterious bridge in which beings from the underworld would appear and spook the initiates and drive them into a state of anxiety and terror. Then there would be a period in which they would be doing a kind of ecstatic dance, and they would imbibe some kind of a magic potion. And the magic potion is believed by some people to date have contained the active ingredients of a fungus that grew on rye in the neighborhood of Demeter. And the actual active ingredients in this fungus may very well have been something like LSD. This isn't known for sure, but there have been rather serious speculations to that effect. After these dances and this march and this exposure to beings from the underworld, the initiates would enter into this remarkable building called the Telesteria, which simply meant the place where the rites were completed. And this building contained, it wasn't just columns that held up the building in the ordinary sense of kind of the building. There were columns all throughout the building, so it had the impression of that you were wandering in some kind of a marble forest, And in this building, in addition, there was a special central chamber, the wasn't actually situated in the center, where at the culminating moment of the rites, something like Demeter and Persephone appear. Now, nobody knows exactly what that means or that how that would happen, but in some way, the entire procession of prospective initiates were exposed to some kind of a very dramatic event that changed the nature of their consciousness. And as a result of that change, their character, their own soul, was supposed to be changed so that when they died and faced the gods of the underworld, they would be in a privileged position.
And the mysteries were really widespread too. I mean, you know, philosophers would go. It wasn't just sort of like a fringe cult that attracted the plebeians or whatever. It was like it was widespread throughout Greco-Roman society, right?
Absolutely. It began just as a local cult in Eleusis, but then it spread to Athens. By the time of the classical period in the 5th century, all the major public figures, cultural figures, were initiated. Philosophers were initiated, the playwrights were initiated, the poets were initiated, the sculptors were initiated, historians were initiated. It spread throughout the society. But at the same time, it wasn't a privileged, democratic thing. Ordinary folks were indeed allowed to be initiated. Women were initiated. Even slaves were initiated. Children were initiated. The only requirements were that you had not committed major crimes like murder, and that you'd be able to speak Greek. So something of the relationship to the Greek language seems to pertain to probably the preparation for the mystery, I think, rather than what actually would have happened in the rite itself. So
right.
That's one of the things that's remarkable, is that though all the major writers of the Greek world initiated, none of them speaks about it in any detail.
Mm. That does stir up the attraction of the mystery. I mean, it seems to me that there are, of course, myriad mysteries of the ancient world around the planet, what religions, what form they took, how they built structures, et cetera, but there's something special about this particular mystery, it seems, because Greek culture is such a core part, at least of the West and its idea of itself, and also that it was so pervasive and it clearly influenced so many people for such a long time, and that really before Christianity, which is in some sense a kind of mystery religion that transforms into this monotheistic cult that ends up taking on a very different form than the pagan mysteries, that before that point it's really the most intense and long-lasting and sort of pervasive mystery religion. And so there's a real charge around this secret, and I'm sure you must have done a lot of research of different accounts that people have made over the years of trying to sort of explain what this marvelous thing might have been. What can you give us a sense of the range of interpretations and how people have tried to figure out what they were up to?
We know that there was certain kind of things that were shown at a certain moment, and nobody really knows what exactly what they were. You have different explanations of what this might have been, that there may have been some kind of a drama that people were exposed to, but there's no clear theory that I'm aware of, until the thing that I made up self, which would give a sense of why this thing was held in such awe throughout the ancient world, because it was certainly the most revered and respected of all of the ancient mystery cults.
I want to get to your interpretation, which is a really striking and remarkable one, but I think the one more element that I'd like to give people who are not familiar with it is a little bit about the basic myth of Demeter and,
okay,
and Persephone.
Sure.
And I just want to start it
sure,
off
sure.
To mention that one of the wonderful things about Charles's book, which is great, is that, you know, in addition to being a scholar, he is a poet, so it's extremely well written, and he also is sensitive to both the literary interpretation of the story as well as the more you know, sort of archaeological and philosophical dimensions of or potential philosophical dimensions of the mystery. So it's a really nice blend, and he includes at the end of his book a his translation of the primary source we have for this myth, which is the Homeric hymn to Demeter. And I just want to read the, because I'm indulgent with myself and I like to read poetry, the opening of the myth, which sort of sets up the story to come, where Demeter's daughter Persephone is wandering in the fields, at play on a gentle meadow, gathering flowers, roses and crocuses, violets and irises, hyacinths, and a new one, Narcissus. This flower Gaia grew as a lure for the flower-like maiden, according to the plan of Zeus to please Polydectes, who is also Hades. It was an amazing radiant flower, a thing of awe to behold for gods or mortals. 100 blossoms grew from the root of it. It had the sweetest of odors, so that all the broad heavens above and all the earth and all the salt swell of the sea laughed for joy, and the girl was amazed. She stretched out both her hands to take the beautiful plaything. But the broad path to earth broke open on the Nicene plain, and the Lord Polydectes leapt up with immortal horses. Polydectes, son of Cronos, the one who has many names. And that theft by Hades of Persephone sets the whole story in motion. And what in terms of the Eleusinian mysteries, are the most important elements of that myth?
Well, first of all, that it's the story of how Persephone becomes the queen of Hades. So the relationship to the underworld is presented. But also at the end of the story, when the way the story goes is that Demeter, her mother, is enraged by the fact that the male gods, Poseidon, Zeus, and Hades, have taken her daughter away, and basically they've divided up the world between them, and Persephone is being taken to be the bride of Hades, that she's enraged by the fact of this, because she, after all, is equal in lineage to the three of them. She's also a goddess of the same stature. She runs around the world trying to find out what's happened, and she finally does find out that this has been the case. And she takes vengeance on the gods by withholding the grain from the earth, withholding the vegetation. And by doing so, she will starve out the humans. And by starving out the humans, there'll be no more sacrifices, and the gods themselves will be denied the very thing that they need in order to remain gods, which is basically human attention. And the things get so dire that eventually Zeus sends Hermes to Hades and says, you've got to give up Persephone, you've got to let her come back. But meanwhile, while this is happening and Demeter is wandering around, she comes to Eleusis and tries to replace her daughter by transforming the son of the king of Eleusis into an immortal by performing magical rituals. And unfortunately, she's found out by the son's by the mother, at which point she explodes and reveals herself as this radiant goddess, and realizes that she's not going to be able to transform him into a god, but what she really has to do is find a way to communicate with the humans in some more appropriate manner. And what she does is she initiates the mysteries. So the story of Demeter and Persephone becomes the basic story for the basic myth for the origins of the mysteries. Since the mysteries do have to do, if the story does have to do with Demeter's desire to create gods to create immortals, it becomes a the moment when Demeter seems to be something about what may have happened at the mysteries themselves, that she may have exploded into light, and people will have an immediate experience of the deity, and that immediate experience is what creates the privileged position that the initiates would be in when they themselves enter Hades.
Well, and I have a question for you. I don't know how much you have researched on this, but I have read in a few different places that some people theorize that one of the things that was taken in the initiation ceremony that had to do with, like, you know, immortality and conference of the god, you know, of the godhead, whether or not that was seeing it in some form, like you said, something was revealed. But there are some theories that perhaps there was consumption of blood in one way or another, and that, of course, ties into all that kind of immortality stuff. And it's, some people think that's, you know, part of where the Eucharist comes from, and like a lot of these other traditions that are tied to grain gods, which of course the Eucharist is one of the big ones, right, that you eat the god, and that's the theophagy thing. And then there were other people that thought it was actually menstrual blood, which has to do with like Demeter and the birthing. And I don't know if in your research, like, did you ever come across any of that kind of thing?
I never came across any explicit evidence of that. It doesn't mean that it wouldn't have been there. It just isn't part of the actual documented material, as far as I'm aware. Nobody knows for sure what that magic potion would have consisted in. The interesting speculation is that it relates to Demeter in the sense of her being the goddess of the things that grow, and
right,
that may have involved not only things that grow in the sense of the civilized production of agriculture and grain and so forth, but of psychotropic plants and medicine. So I
have a question.
The probable connection with the goddess is at that level. There is a sacrifice. There definitely had to be animal sacrifices of the animal sacred to Demeter, which is pigs. Everybody
right.
had to bring a pig to the preparation, and there was a sacrifice of that. But it seemed to be more of a propitiation and a purification. I just am not. I'm not aware of that sanguinary aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
A question about the psychotropic interpretation, because you know I'm on the outside, and I've been familiar with that reading through psychedelic literature, and you do an interesting thing of acknowledging it, but your interpretation does not depend on whether or not this brew was psychotropic, which I think is a very interesting way to approach it. But what I'm curious about is if you read, as you have, the more straight-up, scholarly, academic, contemporary interpretations or reconstructions of the event, has this theory gained any traction, or is it still seen as a marginal speculation from, you know, the countercultural weirdos? Hello?
I'm still here. Did we lose him?
I think we lost him.
The countercultural weirdos.
They didn't want to answer that question. let's see. Are you there, Charles? Oh, we did lose him.
Oh, we'll have to.
While we get Charles back on, we can talk about this interpretation a little bit more. I think the idea is that there was a fungus that grew on the ergot rye, and that there is a form of that that I don't know the chemistry of it exactly. That there's a form of that that is essentially similar to LSD, and it's a very appealing idea because it's so, looking at the material and the little bits that are left of what people said about this experience, including things that you know, that some of the greatest Greek philosophers described about the event, you get the sense of a tremendous experience, that it was hard to imagine how a ordinary theater show in a building could have produced this sense of assurance, of fearlessness in the face of death. Because it couldn't just be a new idea, like, oh, you're going to live forever. The idea that, like, people came out in costumes and there was, you know, lights and incense, it doesn't quite, it doesn't quite make sense. And so it's a very appealing idea, and yet at the same time it always seems a little bit easy to just look at some tremendous mystery in the religious imagination of people and say, well, there must have been a drug. what's your take on it, Maja? You must have looked at some of that material.
Oh, yeah, it's so true. And with a lot of that food of the gods type of thing, right, they always link it back to some kind of psychotropic thing that must be, or and even like witches, right? Like for witches, they all had to be taking drugs to have any kind of experience of divinity. And whenever you say that some kind of divinity was revealed en masse, like everybody says that there has to be some kind of alteration of consciousness, whether that's drinking wine at church or taking drugs, like anything like that, there's always an affiliation of some kind of mind-altering substance. And it's true, like why can't there be ecstatic revelations without some kind of mind-altering substance? Like that's a really profound question that I think a lot of people never really think about, but that there might be some kind of capacity to just have to trigger a spontaneous ecstatic response of an experience of divinity without, you know, spinning around in circles or taking some kind of drug or chanting for 5 hours, like that might actually be what happened at the Eleusinian Mysteries. And that, I think, is probably what has kept it so, like, alive in research and for scholars, because trying to figure out what that trigger could have been is pretty fascinating.
Right. I think we have Charles back. Are you back with us, Charles?
Back, yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Good.
I don't know what happened, but sorry.
You were drawn temporarily into the underworld.
Really? Well, so I've come up with the answer. I can tell you exactly what happened at the Mysteries.
So we were just continuing to talk about the psychotropic interpretation and just whether it's taken seriously by other scholars.
Well, the interpretation was offered by a team of three scholars. One was Gordon Wasson, who is the sort of the prince of research into mushroom cults and so forth. He had a correspondence with Albert Hofmann, the chemist who discovered LSD, asking whether it would be possible for the psychotropic agent to have been the ergot, that is, this fungus growing on the rye in Eleusis. And Hofmann did thorough research on it and said, yes, it would be possible. Then they contacted a classicist named Carl Ruck, who was an expert in ancient botany and ancient botanical practices. And he came up with an argument that said all of the ancient mysteries had to involve something other than wine, because the actual strength of the wine that would have been available in the ancient world was nothing enough to have created the states of consciousness that were possible. And so the three of them together come up with an argument for what this might have been. The only scholar that I'm aware of, I mean really important scholar, who responded to it was Walter Burkert, who was a really great, wonderful writer on ancient Greek religion. And he dismissed it with a series of remarks, which when I read it, I thought, these are really offhand. He really hasn't thought this through. So I thought that it was important for me to rebut his arguments. And that's all that's there. In other words, the initial argument was, is it possible? Yes, it's possible. Is it likely? Yes, it's likely. And Burkert says, well, I don't think it's likely. And I just rebut his arguments to try to reinstate the likelihood that that is the case. But as far as the actual content of the mysteries are concerned, I think something else is going on that I would love to talk about if you would.
Yeah,
would,
you know what? Well, let's get to that. Yeah. But actually, we're right at the half an hour point, so we'll take a break now. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. We're talking with Charles Stein, author of Persephone Unveiled, and we'll be right back.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network. Thoughtful, provocative, cutting edge.
The Ask Dr. Eisenstein Show. Other doctors will scare you of the disease. Dr. Eisenstein will scare you of their treatment. Dr. Eisenstein is a practicing physician for almost 40 years and graduate of several prestigious medical schools. Since 1973, he has been the medical director of Home First Health Services in Chicago. The majority of the 23,000 families in this practice deliver their babies at home, breastfeed their children, choose not to vaccinate, and use natural treatments whenever possible.
Hi, I am Dr. Mayor Eisenstein. If you want to hear the other side of the story, tune in every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for an hour of questions, answers, and lively discussion. Call me with your medical questions. I would love to talk with you.
Hello, this is Eric Ochsner, your host of the best jazz show on the air on Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz. Every Friday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, I play the best jazz ever recorded by Louis, Sidney, Bessie, Billy, and all the others. Remember, Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Record storms, oil and coal mine explosions, stalled climate change and energy legislation. So much to talk about and so many green dots to connect. I'm Betsy Rosenberg, inviting PRN listeners to join me on the Green Front Wednesdays at 2 p.m. East Coast time for the latest green news and views you can use.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind. Eric Davis and myself, Mazadawu, are here talking with Charles Stein on the mysteries of Eleusis. And in his book, Persephone Unveiled, Seeing the Goddess, Reading Your Soul, Charles, you came up with I thought your idea of kind of what the mysteries entailed in that content in them was fantastic. And after I started reading, like, the chapter on death and descent and identity, like, you really started to pull that out. Can you kind of describe for people what it is that is the content of the mysteries, or is that a little too taboo?
No, sure. That's what I'd love to do that.
Great.
If you know anything about the world of classical art and classical culture, what one recognizes is that the Greeks seem to be in love with definite form, very clear. The organized statues of beautiful, beautiful, determined forms of the human body. The plays are exquisitely organized. The poems are exquisitely organized. Everything about Greek culture seems to have the idea of realizing really clear forms and clear identities. And there was a sense in which the classical Greek world and the Greeks in general believed that the goal of human life was to achieve some kind of clear identity, to manifest oneself in a very definite way. And if you look at the accounts of the underworld, particularly the book in the Odyssey, where Odysseus journeys to the underworld and meets a whole series of different people, what happens to these people is they have achieved identity at last. Each one of them is who they were in their life, what their life actually came to define them absolutely. And in the underworld, that's who they are. There's no longer any ambiguity, no longer any possibility for becoming something else. They are what they were, and they hate it. So if you ask the question, what would it mean to be liberated from the fear of death? It would have something to do with what they feared in the underworld. They fear that the very vitality of life is lost. And there's a paradox there, because the ideals of the culture seem to aim towards the realization of identity, and yet there in the underworld, where they have identity, they find it completely ghastly and terrifying.
So my notion was, what must have actually happened at the Telesterion is that they experience a essence of being, the divinity of their own nature, in such a form that releases from them from that obsession with identity, so that when they would go into the underworld, they would no longer fear that they would be confined and boxed in to a complete closure of their own being. So that there must have been some way of experiencing being as such, as that which would manifest identity but not be boxed in by it. So it would be basically that. And that would explain to me what the secret was. Because the secret
would be... Well,
it was
so interesting how you explain the descent and connection to the source, right? Because once you are connected to the source of everything, you're released from, like, individualization and being, like, a separate person. And I really like the part where you kind of talk about, like, the part of Persephone where she goes through this rape by Hades and then becomes identified by that act, like, and how once we have an intimate relationship with chaos and death, that then forms part of our identity. And I was thinking about that, and you mentioned, too, how, like, in Buddhism, they say that you are not the events that happen to you. Like, when things happen to you in your life, that's not your identity. It's not who you are. But in most initiation and, like, in Greek culture, they use those events that happen to you to identify you. And, like, in shamanic cultures too, like, he's the guy that dances with wolves, and, you know, he killed this big deer, so he is now a big deer killer. And, like, then it even changes their names. But that part of what you are getting at in your book, that at the heart of the mysteries, it's about, like, getting to the place that's, like, kind of beyond that.
That's a release from that, yeah. So the secret, why it would have to be kept secret, is because the very essence of that which is most holy is, as it were, subversive of the values of the culture itself.
Mm.
In other words, it's sort of bringing you to a point that if everybody started talking about how great it is not to have identity, what happens to Greek culture? So,
do you have any sense of how this would have been communicated? Is it? Do you still see that as being an ecstatic kind of?
Well, I think somehow, what's happening is, first of all, we have this one version of the myth of Demeter and Persephone that comes to us in this Homeric hymn, which is very definite. But the truth is that there were Demeter cults and the figure of Demeter all over the ancient world. There were goddess cults of different sorts, which were related to Demeter and Persephone, and there were many different versions of the myth. So people would come there without a single idea about what the goddesses were, what the gods were, what divinity was in itself. And in a sense, all of that would have been brought to a head, so that one entered into a space in which the very nature of the divine would open out from the closure of those fixed forms. And the dancing and the exhaustion from the long day's march, the exposure to some mysterious phenomena as they're crossing this bridge and the underworld opens to them. It's like their psyche is being opened up to a space that's beyond the closure of their ego. Then they enter into a space which itself seems like an underworld, this Telesterion with these strange columns. And one thing I didn't mention is that at the culminating moment, when there is a revelation itself, there was a huge fire that kind of exploded in the center of the center, in a place called the Anaxuron. So there was a kind of passage from darkness and anxiety and anticipation into a moment of great luminosity.
Mm.
So if you've been prepared for that in some way by creating a certain kind of confusion, in which all the things that you have trusted are being thrown into a kind of chaos or a kind of multiplicity, and suddenly a great light appears, and your psyche has been opened in various ways, it's very possible that you would have been opened into a space that was beyond the structure of your own concerns and your own ego. That's basically all I can say. One doesn't what has to remember also that in the ancient world and as in the shamanic cultures today, there are all kinds of techniques and processes for inducing different states of consciousness, which we just know very, very little about. When they argued, the Wasson and Ruck and Hoffman argued for the use of the psychedelic substance, a psychotropic substance, the going word is entheogen. The point was not that they just were taking acid and sort of blowing out, that these things would have been used within a very, very carefully orchestrated and well understood sequence of events, the outline of which we have, but none of the details. So it would have been like in the old days when people talked about the set and setting for a trip. That is to say, everything depended on the actual context in which these events took place. And that would be true whether the agent for changing consciousness were a psychotropic substance or whether it were the dances or whatever means. That there would have been some understanding of how to induce the probability of this openness.
Well, and another thing that I was kind of curious in some of your investigation, and part of like how it was so widespread, and there were so many people that did it, there is like a total, like with all mysteries and with the word mystery, there is this mysterium tremens, and that is this kind of element of terror. I mean, the whole myth itself of Demeter and Persephone is not really like lighthearted and let's go tell kids about this nice story. I mean, it's like it's death and it's rape, and part of losing your identity in the world of death, I mean, that is like horrific. And to me, one of the most amazing things is how this society was able to open it to like the general public and the huge community to take something so terrifying and, you know, something no one wants to face, and to have them face it and for it to be effective like that. Do you have any theories about how like the terror was handled and why people were able to kind of, you know, not get obliterated?
Well, I think that's really what I'm talking about, that it's done step by step. If these emotions are awakened in the context of a highly ritualized behavior, they occur at certain moments, and they're compensated for by other moments. So, for instance, what I described they're called the bridge jests. They're walking over a bridge, and the bridge is supposedly crossing a water, a swampland, which is opens to the underworld. And on the one hand, there are people jumping up and taunting them. On the other hand, they're carrying on and making jokes. So they're sort of opening into a space that is both open in the sense of terrifying, but also open in the sense of hilarity. So I think that's one of the ways that it was handled, that there was some kind of combination of different species of opening, the opening of kind of wild humor, kind of Saturnalia. Like atmosphere. I mean, I suppose that's the somewhat familiar idea that we have, the idea of carnival in which everybody's in a mask and there's a tremendous amount of energy and a tremendous amount of good spirits, but also an underlying terror.
Well, and carnival and carnage are related to each other.
Yeah, carnival and carnage, indeed, yeah.
Do you feel like that it's legitimate to try to make correspondences between this and this kind of mystery tradition and things that people are trying to do now, or do you think the nature of identity and the nature of ritual have really changed kind of fundamentally from that period?
Well, my attempt to bridge the gap is really in the philosophical session, the section of my book, the book that's about the concept of being. And I think that the relationship to what we really are and the question that we think we have identities is in a very, very different quality and very different content, but it's essentially the same structure. We have the same situation. We think we're who we are. Our fears and our hopes are based on the stories we tell ourselves about our identities. And if we have a chance to transcend that, it has to do with going through what for many people would be the very terrifying idea of losing one's identity. So that structure, I think, is the same, and I think the inner possibility that there is some kind of redemption from that, or a possibility of an illumination that happens when one is able to actually confront the ambiguity and intensity of one's own nature. That that's really not different. It's different in all its detail, but in its essence, I don't think it's different. So I don't see why there wouldn't be. You know, the problem is when you say this is that, you say the experience of so and so under this particular kind of practice or initiation is the same as the Eleusinian mysteries. It's just reinforcing the very kind of identity that one needs to be liberated from. So I don't think it's necessary to actually have a kind of scholastic argument about whether it's legitimate or not. It's legitimate if it works for you. I mean, that's all I'm saying in my book, really. I'm saying this is a configuration. This is my vision. I try to be as close as I can to the facts, but as a matter of fact, it's an act of imagination.
Yeah, so when you are, like, creating that kind of the sort of argument and the way that you approach these things in the book, I mean, you have you're also kind of coming from multiple perspectives in the sense of being a poet, and you clearly have some interest in experience in spiritual practice and the philosophical dimension, a historical dimension. How is the experience for you of writing and of kind of expressing that creative imagination in terms of organizing or orchestrating these different perspectives? Because it's an unusual mixture of
sure.
perspectives.
Sure. I think the essential thing was my love for that poem. I first became aware of it when I was studying Greek in college decades ago. And I always wanted to translate it. And I actually did translate it some 20 years ago, many years before I actually wrote this book. And I knew that when I wanted to write about Eleusis, the center of it had to be that poem. So it began with the strange poetic feeling of being the poet of that poem. I'm engaged in a lot of translation projects right now. I've recently published a translation of the Odyssey, and I'm working on the Iliad and the other Homeric hymns. And the sense that I have as I'm doing that is that I've entered into the Homeric stream. I've entered into the actual stream of inspiration, which, after all, comes from a period way before the poems were actually written down, passes through the Greek period as the reciters of these poems, and then to the translators. And I think that Homer was a translation from the beginning in a certain sense. So there's a kind of inspiration that has to do with the completely transrational activity of entering into that material and then building the thought around it. The other obsession I have in the ancient world is with that Greek philosopher Parmenides, whom I think is the one thinker that actually connects on to a kind of the kind of visionary possibility that I experience in relationship to Buddhism and other things. That's my opinion. So I knew I was combining those two things. And then at a certain point, the notion that I explained about identity struck me. It just struck me that there was this logic. And once I had that idea, I built the book around that. And then it became necessary also to try to articulate what I actually imagined would have happened in the Telesterion. And so there are those two sections in that book where I give myself over to presenting a vision of that. And what can I tell you? I'm not a historian in any great detail. I've read all of the contemporary works that are on it. Mostly I relied on the book by Carl Carigny, the very famous book on the mysteries of Eleusis, which is just filled with information. It's a wonderful book, but he has a somewhat different view of what that vision actually would be. He imagines it in much more Christian terms, really.
Right. I mean, when I think about what would be a sort of analogous insights in the modern experience, contemporary experience, it's almost like two almost polar opposites, where on the one hand I think of Buddhism and its practice and philosophy of emptiness, or that the core of the self, there is no actual essence of self, and that this understanding can be not only argued philosophically and analytically and arrived at through philosophy, but also can be and should be experienced in the depths of meditation, of a path of quiescence and of internal contemplation, and the arising of a kind of recognition that there really, that nothing actually has a forever imposed, consistent, unwavering identity. And at the same time, the other thing that it makes me think of, particularly the description of the actual ritual itself, with its week long and its combination of revelry and pig roasts and spectacles of light and possible consumption of psychotropic substances, is I think of something like Burning Man, which is another place where people go and kind of lose their identities or allow them to fragment and to reverberate and allow other things to happen, and these other kind of more ecstatic, quote unquote, Dionysian elements of the counterculture and of other other kinds of events. And on some level, these are very different types of experience.
I know. It's really interesting.
Go ahead.
As you're saying that, I'm what's coming to me is that I really do have a particular imaginal vision of it that I really was trying to that was sort of guiding that book, and it is a little bit more. Though it passes through all of this ecstasy and chaos and so forth, it actually is a moment of silent luminosity, and that's what I actually connect to.
Right.
And I think it's in the Demeter poem. It's in that moment when she appears. Suddenly she's there, and she's amazingly tall and there's just this presence of this light, and it's just there for a moment, and something like that happens. So I don't think it connects necessarily to every kind of bacchanalia, ecstatic situation, except in the sense of the breakdown of identity. But I think
right.
there's
well,
this other
element.
One
of the ways I thought you did that so well in the book that I loved is how you talk about how it's the transformations that Persephone goes through that causes that kind of breakdown of the identity, right? Like she goes through those events that transform her, like who she thought she was, she no longer is. And once you go through a transformative event or experience, you're not the person you thought you were, like with
thought
the whole dances with
and
both.
And it's almost like each person who would experience it is redeeming Persephone.
Yeah.
That she herself undergoes this moment of return. With each person who in seeing her, in a sense, becomes her or enters into this transformed condition, but it's just that there is this sense of this transcendent luminous silence that actually is there too, and that it's something of that radiates, as it were, from Eleusis and gave it its enormous dignity. This is the awe with which it was treated for all those centuries.
I'm curious also, like, how do the gods play a role in what you're imagining? Like, what are the gods?
Are they just
metaphors? Are they how? Because it's so important for this experience that there is the story of these gods that in some sense become the people.
I say two things. One is in the book, and one is sort of subsequent to that. I say that a god is a being disrupting or a being creating incursion.
Mm.
That it comes from an unspeakable transcendent place, and if one's condition is being stuck in identity, the presence of the god breaks it. If one's in a state of confusion and chaos, the presence of the god heals it. And the mystery of the god is in that duality. And the other thing that I would say more recently that relates to the whole Parmenides being aspect of the book is that I think each god is a screen or a filter for unique being itself. So the god is potentially a mask that hides being and becomes a kind of reified, idolatrous entity. On the other hand, the god is the, or the goddess is the gateway, the doorway to that which goes beyond it. So the quality of divinity radiates or resonates with the quality of transcendent being. And it's different for each deity. And the deity, it's even different for each individual deity under different conditions, and probably for each individual person. It's completely concrete and completely, it would be completely real. Except at the point when it gets frozen.
Right. I had a great experiential resonance with this idea that the god is what sort of interrupts being, the sense of an incursion, of an invasion, of another order kind of suddenly opening up, because that relates so much to a more modern experience that we are more comfortable talking about, which is epiphany or some kind of momentary insight that arises almost miraculously, a kind of grace of consciousness. And that moment in the poem that you talked to where we suddenly see Demeter's real form, or at least a more accurate form, reminds me of other kinds of theophanies that you see in literature. And rather than think of theophany as just being like, well, here's what the god actually looks like, what the theophany or the appearance is, well, you know, you can think of Krishna in the 11th chapter of the Gita does the same thing, is that it's actually not just about the true form, but the way that a different element or a different dimension of the being cuts through and disrupts our ordinary perception. And it's precisely the rupture that allows for the appearance or for the opportunity of transformation that is what seeing a god or encountering a god or recognizing a god is kind of a...
Sure, absolutely. And there's also the other side to it, which is that if that disruption has occurred, the encounter with the god can be the healing.
Mm-hmm.
It can be the bringing of coherence. So it's trying to imagine what the real Godhead is, what that is. You have to maintain the enigma or the paradox of these opposite.
That's actually where the word corruption comes from. A lot of people don't know that. Corrupt comes from the French part, which is core, and then rupt, which is rupture. And it was used in the Bible that when men looked upon the angels, they were corrupted, which meant that their hearts were broken open. And it made, like, that the angels had some kind of power of doing that exact same thing, that they could cut into them and cause...
Oh, and in the ancient world, too, in the Greek world, too, there's this sense that you're... contact with the god is like a contagion. It's like it's not such a good thing necessarily.
Yeah, exactly.
when in one of the another Homeric hymn, you know, the one to Aphrodite, Aphrodite chooses this Greek hero to be her lover, and when he realizes what's happened, he thinks he's going to die. You can't survive having intercourse with a goddess, and of course that's a big part of the goddess tradition. Really, is that the males who are participated in it are not died, but they're castrated. But still, I want to emphasize that there's this transcendent healing aspect as well as this corrupting aspect, and the real mystery
like
of being is that it.
Go ahead.
That the mystery of the transcendent being is that you can't pin it down as having one quality or the other.
It's
completely
both.
Specific. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Charles, we're wrapping it up here. I wanted to let. Is there a place that people can go online if they want to see more of your writing, or do you have a blog or anything like that?
You know, I'm in the process of preparing a website. One place that one can go is to a website, Bialystocker.net.
Is that right?
Yeah. which is a website by an artist whom I've done a huge amount of collaborating with. He makes very amazing electronic images, and I have many texts that accompany them.
Wonderful. And I just want to remind people that, of course, you're also a published poet and translator, and I really look forward to reading your Odyssey. I haven't gotten my hands on it yet, but I want to thank you again
on Amazon.
Great. I want to thank you again for joining us. This is Eric Davis for Expanding Mind, for Majidahu as well. Keep your minds open.